Welcome back to Radio Boston. I'm Meghna Chakrabarty. On June 4th, 1965, President Lyndon Johnson gave the commencement address at Howard University. It's called the To Fulfill These Rights speech. And in it, Johnson talked about what he called the special thing that was American justice, the opportunity for individuals to fulfill their own potential. However, Johnson stressed that the nation had failed to provide that opportunity for African Americans.
Much of the Negro community is buried under a blanket of history and circumstance. It is not a lasting solution to lift just one corner of that blanket. We must stand on all sides, and we must raise the entire cover if we are to liberate our fellow citizens.
That's President Johnson in 1965. Now, Johnson's war on poverty aimed to provide that lost opportunity to lift up impoverished Americans. So why does Harvard historian Elizabeth Hinton say that Johnson's great liberal agenda is actually the force that gave rise to the world's largest prison system? Hinton's new book is From the War on Poverty to the War on Crime, The Making of Mass Incarceration in America. And she joins us now in the studio. Welcome to Radio Boston.
Thanks for having me, Meghna.
So this is a tremendous book. And any one particular chapter we could spend an hour on. But take me right to the heart of things. I mean, you originally started looking at Nixon's war on crime as one of the sources for mass incarceration. But that took you back to Johnson. And why?
Well, Johnson, shortly before he gave that speech at Howard University, had called for the war on crime. I see it as being his kind of response to the threat of urban uprisings. The nation witnessed urban civil disorder riots in Harlem, Rochester, Brooklyn, Chicago, Philadelphia in the summer of 1964. And policymakers increasingly began to feel that the war on poverty programs were not doing enough to kind of suppress urban violence and generations of black youth who they essentially labeled as criminals.
Okay. I mean, it's interesting because you write about how, funnily enough, Harvard academics actually helped provide the academic justification for the fact that there was, quote, in the words of Harvard President James Conant, black urban poverty was social dynamite that needed to be controlled, like a tinderbox.
Right, exactly. And that was actually as early as 61 in the Kennedy administration, long before the nation actually experienced the kind of collective violence they did first in Harlem. And then, of course, shortly after Johnson's speech 2 months later in August 1965 in Watts. And so the idea was that there needed to be some kind of major federal intervention to deal with the problem of potential delinquency and crime among this group of social dynamite who policymakers and officials very clearly articulated as black youth. What's interesting about the Howard speech, it was actually penned by then Harvard professor Daniel Patrick Moynihan. And although Johnson, you know, makes very kind of grand and in some senses beautiful comments about the history of exclusion and discrimination in this country and how his administration hoped to overcome them, towards the end of the speech, he essentially explains the problem of black poverty as being rooted in black behavior and a cycle of poverty among single-parent families. And this is kind of paraphrased right out of the Moynihan Report. And that view of not kind of socioeconomic forces, mass unemployment, failing public schools as being the root cause of poverty, but black culture and behavior really limited Johnson's view and the kind of potential for war on poverty programs.
So tell us more about how, I mean, we'll talk about Johnson's particular war on crime and that piece of legislation, but how is it that you feel that the war on poverty, the Great Society, failed to reach the goals that Johnson, you know, talked about
right.
in the Howard University speech?
So if poverty is a problem of black behavior, then policymakers reasoned, okay, we can actually fight this war on poverty relatively cheaply. We just need to teach, and this is their language, we need to teach low-income people how to become productive citizens, we need to correct their behavioral deficiencies. So the thrust of the war on poverty programs really included measures like job training, remedial education. So the problem is if you're training people for jobs and then there are no jobs afterwards for them to assume and actually give them concrete channels to mobility and resources, the programs are going to fall short. You're not really going to solve the fundamental root causes of inequality. And as a result, crime, violence, if the main thrust is not kind of addressing these larger socioeconomic issues, crime and violence will continue to worsen, and that's exactly what happened.
Yeah, as you said, in the summer of 64 and in other summers of Johnson's administration. So then in 65, he has this new initiative that you point us to, the War on Crime. It specifically introduces, as you write in the book, the militarization of American police.
Exactly. This is the first time in U.S. history the national government began to invest directly in local and state law enforcement. And for the first 3 years of Johnson's war on crime, it was more modest, relatively experimental. So the federal government began helping police departments in Detroit and Los Angeles and New York and Boston get special military surplus equipment so that they were prepared should an episode of civil unrest reach their communities. So in some senses, it was seen as a riot prevention measure. And at the same time, in addition to kind of militarizing police with surplus from military surplus equipment from Vietnam, policymakers also began to test kind of very new radical experimental crime control programs like tactical squads and new roles for police officers in social programs, et cetera. And many of these kind of early experimental programs ended up getting implemented and expanded on a national basis when Johnson signs the Omnibus Crime Control and Safe Streets Act of 1968, which was really the first major piece of federal crime control legislation and marked a nearly $400 million investment into state and local law enforcement for the first time in our history.
And at the, concurrently, between, as you write in the book, between 64 and 71, money that was supposed to support the Great Society starts shifting towards these crime control measures.
Exactly. So the investment, we see the investment in kind of law enforcement assistance increase while the investment in social welfare programs decreases. And even, you know, the perfect example is the Office of Economic Opportunity, which was formed in 1964. It was kind of the central agency of the War on Poverty. We never got a more permanent, larger Office of Economic Opportunity. Instead, we do get a larger, more permanent Office of Law Enforcement Assistance, which was the first kind of federal office that handled these experimental grants. That becomes more permanent in the form of the Law Enforcement Assistance Administration. And increasingly, through the 1970s, the Law Enforcement Assistance Administration that's operating through the Department of Justice assumes more and more of the previous responsibilities of programs that were being operated through the Office of Economic Opportunity. So programs that were originally seen as health, education, and welfare programs are increasingly kind of getting funding as juvenile delinquency programs. And then, of course, law enforcement officers and officials are taking on really important roles in shaping the direction and the implementation of these programs.
And then, of course, it just gets further entrenched with Nixon.
Exactly.
And subsequent administrations, both Democratic and Republican. I mean, I have to ask you, I mean, you write very clearly in the book that as the product of one of the most ambitious liberal welfare programs in American history, the rise of punitive federal policy over the last 50 years is a thoroughly bipartisan story. What are we to take from that? What's the lesson there?
Well, the current criminal justice reform efforts are also thoroughly bipartisan. You have Van Jones working with Newt Gingrich on efforts to decarcerate and kind of scale back the massive prison system we have in this country. We're the largest incarcerator in the world. And Democrats and Republicans have always been on board for this kind of approach to urban crisis. And I think part of it is that really both Johnson and, you know, Republicans like Strom Thurmond, segregationists in Congress, were able to rally behind this idea together because of the ways in which racism and kind of assumptions about Black Americans' poverty and crime shapes policy outcomes. So in some senses, the determination to police the social dynamite, the potential juvenile delinquents, et cetera, which are increasingly framed as Black urban youth, becomes a really powerful unifying force within domestic policies, beginning with the Johnson administration and lasting in some ways till today, where we're beginning to see new directions in criminal justice reform during Obama's second term.
Yeah, we're seeing those new directions, but one wonders if the same fundamental problems exist if
exactly.
We're not going to build up the programs
mm-hmm.
needed to support. Now we have the newly decarcerated as well.
Right, and the reentry system is kind of the new frontier. We cannot let those programs look like the War on Poverty. We need job creation programs. We need access to education and real avenues to mobility and opportunity for our formerly incarcerated citizens. People deserve second chances, and we need to really commit to giving that to the people who we've locked behind bars under increasingly punitive sentences for the past half century.
Well, the book is The War on Poverty to the War on Crime, The Making of Mass Incarceration in America. It's by Elizabeth Hinton. She's a professor of history and African American studies at Harvard, and African studies as well. Thank you so much.
Thank you. It's been a pleasure.
It's been a great pleasure. I'm Meghna Chakrabarty. This is Radio Boston.